Next case is Moore versus the Commonwealth of Virginia, Ms. Powers and Mr. Stollard. I believe Ms. Powers was the most upset. We hadn't broken for lunch.
Be all nervous and then take a break.
Ms. Powers, of course, you have 15 minutes. You may reserve whatever time for rebuttal that you wish, but keep track of.
Yes, Your Honor.
We'll try to help.
If I may reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. May it please the Court, Allison Powers from the Fairfax Public Defender's Office on behalf of Mr. Moore. The trial court erred in considering a both irrelevant and unadmitted piece of evidence regarding a letter that was never received by the trial court as an aggravating factor in sentencing Mr. Moore in this case. It's very clear that the standard is abuse of discretion, and we know from Commonwealth v. Lawler that when an irrelevant or improper factor is considered and given significant weight, that it is an abuse of discretion.
Under Harvey, which, of course, we spent a lot of time this morning talking about, why isn't it a piece of information the court could have considered? And setting aside how it got in front of the court, we'll talk about that in a minute, but why isn't this something that he was trying to influence to the point of suggesting he would either write or, in the light most favorable to you, I guess, help rewrite or edit letters that were intended to influence the court? Why under Harvey can't he consider that conduct? Can a sentencing judge not consider that conduct?
Well, Your Honor, I think that sort of goes to the second prong of my argument, which is the relevance portion. And certainly we know that relevance is a threshold for any admissibility of any piece of evidence. And I would argue that this, the consideration of the jail tape, which was, at least in the view of the Commonwealth, a conversation between Mr. Moore and his girlfriend regarding a potential letter that she may have written to submit to the court. We have so many layers of issues regarding how that becomes relevant to the trial court.
And is there any dispute that it's him?
No, Your Honor.
Okay.
There is not a dispute that it's him.
Right.
However, that doesn't answer the question of its relevance.
But it does answer its question of whether it's reliable or not, doesn't it?
Well, I think in terms of it being his voice, we did concede that it was him on the jail tape. But the Commonwealth's version of what is going on in that tape is kind of taken and run with. And I think that's where we come into the relevance issue is certainly in a sentencing hearing, we have broader rules regarding what is admissible and what is relevant, but it is not totally without check.
If it is relevant, and I understand that you do not adopt that position, and I'm not asking you to adopt that position, if it is relevant, is there anything that would preclude its admission or the court's consideration of it?
If it is relevant. I at that point, I still would maintain that there needed to be some further investigation regarding what was going on in that phone call, because it was clearly at issue of the Commonwealth is saying, here's what's going on. The defense at that point was put in an awkward position because clearly the trial court was considering it as a much greater factor than Mr. Moore and myself wanted them to. And I think at that point, it would have been more prudent for the court to engage in a little bit more of an evidentiary hearing regarding what, in fact, was going on in that tape, whether it was through testimony or...
Well, and although he may have felt compelled to do so, given the Commonwealth's theory as to the significance of the tape, your client offered, you argued, that there was another way to interpret the tape. But that strikes me as a classic. The facts could be read this way, it could be read that way, and that's something we would defer to the sentencing judge on, isn't it?
Yes, but I think I know that the court wants me to assume that it is relevant, but I think at that point it goes back to the relevance issue of how is this possibly relevant under the expanded rules that we have in the case law that we have regarding what is admissible. And certainly we have the victim impact statute that kind of talks about who victims are and what they can testify to, which I think is more of what Harvey goes to. But the evidence has to be related in some way and relevant to that sentencing proceeding. And we have
if he had actually written all of the letters that were submitted on his behalf, that would be relevant.
If the letter that was referenced on the jail tape was submitted, yes, I believe we would be in a much different position if the jail tape was only one letter. There were additional letters that were submitted that are not the subject of
But if that's relevant, isn't it relevant because it shows his attempt to exert influence surreptitiously on the information provided to the judge, that it's not really coming from the third persons, it's just coming from him. So if the letter, if he had actually written all the letters, that would be relevant. But if the reason it's relevant is because it shows that he was attempting to influence the judge without the judge knowing that it was him, why isn't an attempt to do that also relevant?
I think in that case, it is more akin to the Brown versus Commonwealth case, which is out of this court, where the defendant in that case was indicted for a burglary, but sentenced on facts of a different burglary. And the reason why I say that those are similar is that it is almost as if the court in Mr. Moore's case is sentencing him for misleading the court regarding this letter that has nothing to do with the facts of his case. And so I would liken it to that, and that then makes it irrelevant because the court in that case said, even if there is facts that are similar, which is in this case Mr. Moore misleading the complaining witness in this case, which was the Commonwealth's entire theory, and him attempting to mislead the court through this letter, those are two completely different things. And he is being sentenced regarding the pandering case, not about trying to have a letter being written on his behalf.
Can I ask you on the relevance? Clearly, on Joint Appendix 58, you talk about, I still maintain that it is not relevant, and that is preserved. That objection would certainly be, in my mind, preserved there. Can you talk a little bit more about where you preserve for appeal the question of, well, it wasn't admitted into evidence, so therefore there's a problem?
Well, I think in terms of, it is never actually admitted into evidence affirmatively on the
right. As the do you say something to the court at some point about that? I mean, is that something that
I don't recall making an affirmative objection about it being admitted or not, because the way that the sentencing hearing went is we kind of delved right directly into its relevance and whether it was relevant and how it had been listened to prior to the hearing. And it wasn't till after we kind of went back and looked at what had been admitted and what had not been admitted, realizing that it had not been admitted, there was not a objection saying I
object. Or a motion for reconsideration later based on that.
No, there was not. There was not.
And that's really, given the way this played out, that's really elevating to some level form over substance. If it were relevant, and recognizing you don't concede it were relevant, then there would have been no problem with its admission otherwise,
right. And
therefore it would have been perfectly appropriate. And so it's just a question of whether the court said the magic words, I'm admitting it, as opposed to it was clear it was in front of the court and the court was considering it. It's not like we have a jury in the box. It's a sentencing judge.
Right, exactly. And certainly those, its admission versus its relevance are intimately intertwined in the procedure of this case. But I would point the court to Hess versus Commonwealth, which is a court of appeals case. And that case, I think, is very instructive on what information can be considered by judges, and in that case it was the same judge had sat at a misdemeanor trial on a probation violation, and the judge was remembering was very explicit about considering facts that had not been admitted at the probation violation. And in this case, we have that very exact same issue. We have it's very clear, I would submit from the record, that the trial judge considered and heavily weighed the consideration of this jail tape about the potential letter.
But the jail tape arose in this case. It was provided to him in this case as part of this case. It was argued by counsel in this case. The only issue on the it wasn't admitted is he never said it's admitted, but everybody knew he was considering it.
Yeah, but I think that's an important distinction, that considering evidence that hasn't been formally admitted, I mean, then we...
To which no objection to its admission other than relevance was raised.
Correct. Well, it was never formally moved into evidence, so there was no opportunity.
Of course, I mean, if you object to it even not being admitted, then it probably won't be admitted.
Exactly. Yeah, that's where I was going, is I would then, if I object to something before it's potentially admitted, then, you know, I'm kind of inviting the court to then admit it. And I also think it's important to consider that in this case, this
piece of... But if you don't object to its consideration at some point, then how do you have the argument preserved?
Well, I objected to its relevance. And
but
again,
that's a different question.
It is.
And that's kind of the point of 518, so mm-hmm. the trial court can fix a problem then rather than our having to
right.
maybe deal with it later.
Mm-hmm. And in this case, one of the important considerations, I think, is that this was not a piece of evidence that, while, yes, counsel was on notice, I received the tape and knew that it was probably going to be subject of a discussion, it wasn't as though this was provided in discovery or given at the proffer, that it was a piece of evidence that had been known and was being given significant weight either to surprise or... that the counsel should have known that it would have been important to raise and discuss. With regard to, I think we've covered relevance, and just touching on that back briefly, is that the sentencing hearing is not everything can come in, and there are certainly irrelevant pieces of evidence that come in. They come in PSIs, and we object to them. There is victim impact testimony, whether in the form of letters or in the form of testimony, that is objected to as irrelevant or outside the scope of whether it is statute or case law, and I would argue that this falls certainly within that realm. And finally, this is certainly not harmless error. Mr. Moore was sentenced 5 times above the high end of the guidelines, and while, yes, within the statutory scheme, it is akin to Turner v. Commonwealth and Whitehead v. Commonwealth, who both of those cases spoke to the court having to engage in speculation regarding evidence that was admitted and considered and was clearly influential. And in this case, we know that this was clearly influential on the trial court. If I can reserve for rebuttal. Thank you.
Sir. Mr. Stollard.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. Craig Stollard on behalf of the Commonwealth. This tape was relevant for a number of reasons, mainly because it showed the defendant's attitude towards the court, towards the system, towards the crime, and towards the victim. Basically, he didn't care. It was basically, what can I do to help myself at sentencing? Showed absolutely the reverse of remorse and showed that he was trying to manipulate the system to his own benefit, regardless of who the victim was, what impact he had on the victim's life. And for those reasons, this is highly relevant, and the court properly considered it. There is, as the court noted, the case of Harvey says basically, I think anything in aggravation or anything in mitigation, the court's free to consider to come up with an appropriate sentence. That's what the judge does. It's one of the most difficult things a judge can do, is to figure out what is the appropriate thing for me to do in this case. And the more information the judge has, I think the better off they are in making the proper decision. Here, having information that, in the light most favorable to the Commonwealth, basically he's dictating to a third party a letter to send to the judge under the guise of someone else saying, hey, he needs a break for these reasons. And interestingly, that would be the only letter that would have been submitted that dealt with the fact that the victim had no obvious signs of mental deficiencies, which was one of the issues at trial, one of the reasons, another reason the trial judge went over the guidelines. So this would have been a unique letter among other letters that were sent for that reason. And for the judge to think, well, you know, he's trying to manipulate me through a third party on this one factor, which is he did find relevant because it's like one of the, he went like five or six reasons why I'm going over the guidelines, which I think, again, fully appropriate. Highly relevant because that's a specific issue that the defendant himself was talking about, which the judge found to be not credible.
So if it were error, it would not be harmless.
If it is error, no, it's not harmless, but it's not for the reasons I think counsel stated. It's not because he went over the guidelines. It's because the judge said, I'm relying on this in coming up with the sentence. I think nothing to do with guidelines, anything to do with this. As earlier, again, also in argument during one of the writs, Judge Beals mentioned the statute with the guidelines in it, and subsection F does say nothing about the guidelines is appropriate for appeal. Not to be post-conviction, not collateral attack, nothing. It's just guidelines, discretionary, that's all they are. So the fact the judge went over them is not evidence of anything. It's the judge, when they go over, they have to state a reason why, and the judge did. He stated, like I said, five, six, maybe seven reasons why the judge went over the guidelines. Only one of those is now being challenged. So, but because he did mention it, I think it would not be harmless error because he said, this is why I'm doing it. So he clearly relied on that evidence. But it's not because he went over the guidelines, because he said he was relying on it. Because even if he stayed within the guidelines, if he shouldn't have considered it, he said he did, I think it would still be, you could not have a harmless error argument. But again, I don't believe there is error. The tape is highly relevant for a number of reasons. The judge probably considered it. And as such, I think the court should affirm. I'd be happy to answer any questions the court may have.
There are none.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Sal.
I think it's important for the court in this particular case to go back to the Commonwealth's specific objection, which is at the Joint Appendix 33, and it specifically states, the Commonwealth objects to the defendant preparing letters which are purported to be written by others for this court to consider at his sentencing, which is exactly what the court did. They have placed this jail tape, which they are in their own objection objecting to, the content of this letter, in front of the court and for consideration of the court. And certainly the Commonwealth's argument is that even if he, you know, didn't consider, if we remove the jail tape from the consideration and we know that the trial court enumerated five or six reasons why they went over the guidelines, that it would be harmless error. But Turner versus Commonwealth and Whitehead versus...
I understood Mr. Schaller to say it wouldn't be harmless error, that he concedes that point.
Oh. Excuse me, then I misheard him. But those, for the, because it's not relevant, and he puts so much emphasis on them, this case has to be remanded for a new sentencing hearing.
Well, if I understand the major thrust of your argument, it rises and falls under whether, under Harvey, this could have been relevant for the court to consider. If it was relevant, then everything else is okay. If it wasn't relevant, we have to reverse.
I think the fact, yes, but also the fact that it was not admitted is a very important issue for the court to look at as well. And I think Hess versus Commonwealth is directly on point about that. I understand that this was raised at the hearing, but we have to have some kind of guard on what is considered at sentencing hearings. They can't just be that anything that anyone says.
Well, you can see that sentencing, it's at least considerably more relaxed than a trial.
Absolutely.
So why here, just taking that a step further, why, given, as you say, if objection had been made, and it probably would have been admitted, if that's the issue, really what is the harm if it just wasn't admitted and was considered as long as it's relevant?
Well,
for the sake of my question, we have to assume it's relevant.
Yes. I think just procedurally, it's important for there to be more of that formality in the sentencing hearing. And certainly, again, they are much more relaxed. And but they're still governed by the rules of evidence. And we have to remember that, that things in order to be admissible have to be relevant. And we have to have the proponent of that submit it in the way that is proper, and then have the court make that determination.
Was it inappropriate for you to, for your client to submit letters to the judge outside of the presence of other counsel and not move them into evidence, to submit them to the court without them having been moved into evidence?
I don't think it was inappropriate in the sense of how sentencing hearings are conducted. However, I will concede that those were not moved into evidence, and it would have been better, certainly, and certainly as a defense bar and as a personal practitioner, those should have been moved in. But there was also no objection made to those. So
I
think
guess part of the point is they didn't have to be moved into evidence to be considered.
Well, I'm not sure that on the record there was any evidence that they were considered. There was a listing.
He said he read them.
I think he said that he had received the letters. But I still, again, there was no objection to those being relevant or not. And those, that is specifically outlined as mitigating evidence that can be submitted. And I think that is where the jail tape
and an attempt to mislead such mitigating evidence would not be relevant to the court.
Well, again, I think it goes back to the fact that the letter was never submitted.
Could that be because the judge got the jail tape in advance of things? So there was a calculated decision made not to submit the letter when it's contested in that fashion?
It could have been, or it could have been that it never actually existed and was never written.
But the natural inference in the negative for the defense is something that would be easy for the court to conclude.
It would be, but the court didn't engage in that type of balancing in this case, and I think that's where the issue
verbally becomes.
Yeah, on the record that we have no evidence of that. That's correct.
As you can see, your time has expired. Thank you. As consistent with the court's custom, we'll come down and greet counsel.